Good morning, everybody. Thank you for coming. It's a real honor to be presenting with all of my colleagues and friends, and thanks to you in the audience who've worked on this project with us for several years now. I'm going to talk to you this morning about the... It seems like my slides are moving automatically. The lessons that we learned in administering the DECIDE efficacy effectiveness trial, particularly in under-resourced, in community mental health settings. I have no disclosures. The grant was funded by the National Institute of Minority Health and Health Disparities, and as Maggie said, the DECIDE study is based on the methods and experience of the Right Question Project, of which Luz is the co-director. There's been a tremendous growth in interest in how to activate patients, how to empower patients to ask questions and participate in decisions in the clinical encounter. This editorial from JAMA earlier this year talked about how to overcome white coat silence. So perhaps we've all heard of white coat hypertension, where your blood pressure goes up a little bit when you go visit the doctor. I thought this was a neat analogy in describing how patients can lose their voice in the encounter with physicians because the clinical environment and the power differentials all make it so that it's tough to ask questions, it's tough to speak up. So it's important to develop interventions that can be used in the places where they're most needed, with the patients who most need them. The landscape of intervention research is shifting, and we've moved from efficacy or explanatory trials, which are highly standardized and really focused on internal validity, to effectiveness or pragmatic trials, which are more emphasizing broad criteria, broad outcomes. Feasibility is very important, and real-world relevance is the main goal. And then there's a growing field of implementation research where the emphasis on dissemination and adoption by community providers. The DECIDE study was a hybrid of explanatory and pragmatic approaches, and most studies are going to lie in various ways on that continuum. So what I want to talk about is the lessons we learned in making decisions about how we ran the study. So the aim of our study was to improve activation and self-management, but also to improve engagement and retention in care, the number of visits that participants were actually attending with their therapists or their psychiatrists. It was a large sample. We recruited 724 participants from 13 community-based mental health clinics in a number of sites in the United States and in Puerto Rico. And with great hopes, the results are going to be published in JAMA Psychiatry next year. We hope. The paper's under review. And the challenge for us was how to efficiently test an intervention in low-resource mental health settings. So I want to talk to you about the PRACE criteria, a tool to improve intervention design, which I found a useful rubric for understanding how to make decisions in planning a trial. PRACE stands for Pragmatic Explanatory Continuum Indicator Summary, and it was published by Thorpe in 2009. And the idea of PRACE is that it helps researchers place a trial on that continuum I was talking about, between pragmatic and explanatory, or between effectiveness and efficacy, across 10 specific domains, which I'll describe. Again, pragmatic trials being the type of trial that helps choose between different options of care, while explanatory are more trials that test causal research hypotheses. And the design for these different types of trials are quite different. So here are the 10 domains, ranging from how you select your eligibility criteria, how flexible you allow the intervention to be, what type of expertise you expect of the people who are delivering the intervention, what type of comparison intervention are you going to choose, and what type of expertise is expected of the comparison group, how intensely are you going to follow up your participants, and what outcomes are you going to choose, and how are you going to analyze those outcomes. How are you going to measure compliance with the intervention and adherence to the research protocol? So I'm going to select a number of these that I think are most relevant to the discussion today. But in the end, if you go through each of those domains and you plot them in the way that this diagram represents, with the E in the middle being explanatory and the ends of those lines being pragmatic, then you can get a broad sense of where your trial lies along this continuum. So this is an example from the Thorpe paper that I referenced earlier of aspirin trial. And you see that most of the dots lie along the edge of the diagram, suggesting that this was more of a pragmatic trial. So you can take a look at this graph and see, in the implementation of the project, did this measure up to how we wanted to run the study? So the first domain I want to talk about is participant eligibility criteria. The decision we were facing was, do we recruit any patient from usual care, or only those most likely to complete the trial? So our experience was we used broad eligibility criteria with the goal of yielding a sample that was very diverse in terms of diagnoses and treatment type. But what we found is that IRB standards varied across our 13 sites. Some sites didn't have any IRB oversight at all. Others had other stipulations for participants. For example, one site wanted us to do the mini-COG test to assess dementia among elderly patients. So these differences can introduce a lot of extra work and require a lot of extra planning. So if you're going to have a pragmatic recruitment approach like we did, it will benefit your generalizability of your results, but prepare for variation across IRBs or even absence in IRB oversight. And for those sites that didn't have an IRB, they would fall under the main IRB. The second domain to discuss is the flexibility of the experimental intervention. So the decision here is, do you adapt the intervention to the particular setting of each site, or do you remain rigidly consistent across each site so that there's high standardization? So our experience with the DECIDE study was we used a manual. This is a bilingual manualized approach that was highly standardized. But in training the care managers who delivered it, we encouraged them to use their own language and style when teaching patients. As long as they conveyed the core content of the manual, we felt that the delivery of the intervention would be more effective when the care managers used their own style. And we used adherence checks to make sure they were covering all the bases. 60% of our participants spoke Spanish as their first language, so it was crucial that the staff and the outcome measures were bilingual. So I think that's one of the most important lessons of our experience running this study. Interventions in culturally diverse mental health settings should flexibly accommodate delivery in relevant languages. In the study that Maggie mentioned now, the PCORI study, we're translating the manual further into Mandarin and or Cantonese. Now the third domain to discuss is the experimental intervention practitioner expertise. So what kind of expertise do you expect of the people delivering your intervention? Do you use local staff who you hire from the clinics, or do you use highly trained research that you hire yourself and then export to the sites? So the individuals that delivered the DECIDE study were called care managers, and we had a range of background in our care managers. We had a research analyst, a teacher, several psychology interns, one was a mediator, and a few were social workers. The way we were able to use these individuals with such a variety in background was intensive supervision and training with fidelity checks. And the structure of supervision was weekly check-ins as a group, which was really important for the group to provide support to each other because the experience of the care manager was rather isolated. They were in the clinics by themselves trying to recruit patients and deliver the trainings. But having phone check-ins every week was a great experience to provide support to each other and share experiences. Now, when we were hiring local staff as we did, again, there's a lot of variability across the different sites in what the institutions expect in their hiring process. So some sites might have required vaccinations, others not. Some might have required background checks, others not. This requires a lot of preparation in advance to see what kind of a timeline you're working with when you need to hire individuals or when you have turnover in your staff, and that happened often. Care managers would find different work, or they'd go back to school, or they'd start a family, and you'd have to be very adaptive in hiring new individuals quickly, training them quickly, and getting them up to speed. So we found that rigorous supervision and training gives you flexibility in staff expertise, which will make it easier for you to hire from local staff, but prepare for delays due to local site requirements. The fourth domain I want to talk about is the comparison intervention. So your decision here is, You use usual care if you're implementing a trial like ours? Or do you use an idealized group that will highlight the differences with your intervention? So in our experience, usual care really varied across the sites, and clinic cultures really varied across the sites. And it was very important to try and make a tremendous amount of effort to understand the local expectations about research and the local processes for delivering care. There was a lot of heterogeneity in outcomes. So I told you that we measured service use as one of our outcomes. Well, some of our sites were in the habit of delivering long-term psychodynamic therapy. So it was very normal for participants to have 50 visits. Other sites worked with individuals who came for a much shorter period of time. So when you're measuring the effect of an intervention on service use, you have to be ready for this type of heterogeneity so you can incorporate that in your analysis. And I would note that some staff in some of the sites we visited were very protective of their patients, and so they were wary of research participation. So the lessons that we learned were: collect contextual data before you enroll sites. Ask them to provide you with characteristics of their patients and of their providers. Not only will that tell you what type of population you'd be collaborating with, but you also get a sense of how difficult or easy it is for the sites to provide you with that information. And that can be immensely instructive for when it comes time to collect data down the road. Make site visits. We visited all of our sites to establish face-to-face relationships with the providers, with the directors. Each site had a local site investigator. So Michelle Allen and Gabby Levestein were site investigators for their respective sites in Minnesota and North Carolina, and they were extremely important ambassadors for the study. Screen for similar interventions. So we were running an activation intervention, and we did find that there was a similar intervention encouraging activation in the Minnesota site. So we came up with a process for screening specifically for that local intervention and making sure those participants were enrolled in our study. And that's an effort to minimize contamination. And then identify shared perspectives and synergy. This is really important in the site visits that you do. We were bringing intervention whose goal was to activate patients and improve self-management. So that met with a lot of encouraging sympathies at the sites that we were collaborating with, fortunately. So I think it really helped us in being successful at each site. Okay, follow-up intensity. How intensely do you want to follow your participants in a study? You want to have no contact with participants. You enroll them, and then maybe you follow up their service use data later without having any contact with them. Or do you want to use highly structured interviews with very frequent contact so you can collect a lot of data and do longitudinal analyses? Well, our structure was we had three trainings as part of the intervention, a fourth booster if needed, and three research interviews. Everybody got three research interviews. So that's about six or seven contacts in the intervention group and three in the control group. Now, follow-up was affected by many, many variables. The participants we worked with had cognitive and emotional challenges, low literacy, social stresses, sometimes even inappropriate behaviors where participants would flirt with the care managers. This introduces a need to be very proactively conscientious about how you're going to run the follow-up visits. For example, building in opportunities to end a visit if you have to, and being explicit about that with participants at the beginning. You can end a visit if you need to for any reason, and so can I. And that makes it easier for your staff to be flexible in a training or an interview if needed. Our staff faced a lot of restrictions in space, in computer access, and telephones, obviously. So this has a big impact on how your follow-up can be successful or not. So the lessons we learned here was prepare for intensive and flexible contact with both patients and providers to reduce attrition. Try and get a sense of what clinic resources are available. And we found centralizing resources at our site was important. For example, using phone interviewers to do research interviews when your research interviewer at a remote site leaves. We found that we would train staff to be care managers or research interviewers for different sites, just building in flexibility to work with the inevitable barriers that you run into. Okay, as we wrap up, we'll talk about primary trial outcomes. So your decision here is do you select clinically meaningful outcomes that are very easy to obtain, or narrowly defined outcomes requiring expert interviews? So we tried to have our cake and eat it too. We measured service use, which is clinically meaningful and easily obtained. We also had research interviewers ask about activation and self-management. Collecting service use data required a lot of IT support from sites locally, or when there was no IT support, direct chart review, which was tough. So use redundant centralized approaches and try and collect granular data. So if you collect a lot of information, that can allow you to answer unexpected research questions later. So I'll wrap up there. We have a website, a Twitter feed, a Facebook page. We're all here afterwards. Please follow our work. We'd love to talk to you more about this. Thanks very much.